was like.
Good morning, Mr. Jacobs. Can you hear us?
I have seven more days.
Morning.
I'm sorry.
Good morning. Can we get a little more volume on you?
Seven more days of fun, guaranteed to me.
Was Andy going to switch the thing that was going to affect that?
Yeah, I hated that place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We're trying to get the audio adjusted, Mr. Jacobs.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's just Andy needed to flip a switch and.
Okay. If it was this quiet, we might be able to hear him.
Can I test the audio again? Can you hear me?
Oh, that's much better.
Oh, yeah, that's better. Okay. So we must have flipped a switch somewhere. Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. Colleagues, thank you for being here. We're having an informational meeting today, sort of looking at the working poor as such and some of the demographics around that, trying to highlight some of the problems we face with serving the population that that works and can't quite make ends meet. So we're just sort of examining that issue from a couple of different perspectives, and we're starting out with Ken Jacobs this morning, who's Skyping from Berkeley, I assume, or someplace down in that neck of the woods. So with that, Mr. Jacobs, why don't you introduce yourself and give us sort of an overview and of your self and get right to talking about the study that you've been working on.
Great. My name is Ken Jacobs. Again, I'm the chair of the UC Berkeley for Labor Research and Education. And in that role, I've carried out research on low-wage work, health benefits, and the effects of labor standards policies. Most recently, I served on the research team to assess the prospective impact of minimum wage laws in Seattle and Los Angeles, and the recent report of the thank you for inviting me to participate today. This morning, I wanted to talk about some of the trends in income inequality in Oregon, a specific focus on what's happening with low-wage workers, discuss our research on the public cost of low-wage work, and then touch on briefly some of the causes and policy solutions. So in terms of the trends, income inequality has risen sharply in Oregon and the rest of the United States since the late 1970s. And while earnings rose at a strong pace at the top, the median wage in Oregon, adjusted for inflation, was 5% lower in 2014 than in 1979. And the largest wage declines were in the bottom third of the workforce, which is the issue in discussion today. If we add benefit costs to the equation, wages at the median have essentially been stagnant, while at the same time, productivity rose about 141%. So when I took Econ 1, I was taught that compensation rose with productivity, which was really true up until the late 1970s. And that since that time, we've seen a strong divergence with gains going to the top. And I'll come back to some of the reasons for that in a minute. So in terms of the trends for low-wage workers, for the purpose of this presentation, I'm defining low wage as less than two-thirds of the median wage, or $13.30 an hour in Oregon. For a full-time worker, that's $26,600 a year, though most earn much less. Low-wage workers in Oregon, as in the rest of the United States, are both older and more educated than any time in the past. In 1979, 8% of low-wage workers were teenagers. By 2014, only 5% were teenagers. The median age of low-wage workers
So, Mr. Jacobs,
yes.
we're having some audio problems at the moment. Can you just pause for a minute?
Sure.
We may have to have you call in if we can't figure this out.
All right. No problem.
Technology sometimes escapes us in Oregon.
Yeah, you're clear. So, but
it's an Oregon problem.
It's got to be a California problem, I think.
No, it's Oregon problem.
We don't have problems in Oregon.
Sorry.
Andy's number. We're having
can we put him on our phone?
Well, we'll have to get one.
Okay, thanks.
We're off to our usual start.
So it's a connection problem on his end. Do you want to switch to a phone?
Well, we may have to, and we'll have to readjust the agenda a little bit to accomplish that.
Do you want to switch to Sheila and we'll set the phone up?
Yeah. Okay. So, Mr. Jacobs, we're going to have to probably switch to a phone conference with you, which will take a little bit. So we're going to, you can continue to watch probably until somebody turns you off, I guess. I don't know when that'll happen exactly, but we need to get a phone set up for your testimony. And so I apologize for that. It could be a net neutrality issue. So with that, we're going to proceed with another one of our testifiers for right now. We'll come back to you as soon as we got our phone set up.
Ask for the best number to call him, please.
Oh, and we would need a phone number for us to call you.
Call me at 510-643.
Could you repeat that?
You'll have to repeat it.
Write it on a piece of paper and hold it up to the screen.
Now we're talking.
We are like so high tech.
We're back to the basics again.
Yeah.
So.
We're real high tech here.
Back when, you know, well, no, they said it was a California connection. Come on now.
The two states don't have us.
And technology thing. No, and there was
he doesn't have paper in his office.
Okay, fine.
It's a paperless office.
There we go.
There we go.
Is that, can you read that, or is that too light?
That's pretty good.
643-2621.
Repeat it. See.
Oops.
Oh, maybe we'll be able to get you quicker than we thought. Of course, we're still on the microphone.
Two-way wrist committee. Here we are, right?
This is.
Hello? Whoa.
Dick Tracy's in there.
Maybe we should end the Skype connection.
Yes. Go ahead and
can we kill the Skype audio?
Matthew, can you kill the Skype somehow now?
Kill the Skype
audio. Let me kill the Skype audio.
Over in Holland.
Yeah, I'll do that.
No, we're getting feedback.
Oh, wow. That's like awesome.
Some things aren't meant to be.
This is like
this is like the
outer limits.
Teach you in more ways than one, Mr. Chair, in more ways than one.
Okay. Not yet.
11:95.
It's like a presenter's worst nightmare.
This isn't our first time with Skype, but
thank you.
Every once in a while, I have to. Get
we should have probably started 15 minutes early.
Just flip chart things and make, you know.
That would have been fun.
Just have to
bring it. Yeah.
Everything's in PowerPoint, and I always stress, like, is it going to work?
Mr. Jacobs, can you hear us?
In this computer, you know, I've never done.
Let's see if we can get our volume adjusted here.
How's that? Any feedback? I'm going to just hang up and call again.
Yeah. Well, so I need a workshop.
I think I had a dream about this happening.
I think that was a good talk. Better be here. But I got down.
We got a good connection there on his answering machine.
I'm surprised.
Yes, I think so.
It was on my end. Okay, I just figured it out.
Yeah.
Weird things happen at Berkeley.
All right. Okay.
All right. Back to Berkeley. Would you like to try again?
Sure. Okay.
Perfect.
Starting from the top here.
And your name is. Let's start with that again.
Yeah. Okay. So. My name is Ken Jacobs. I'm the chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. And in that role, I've carried out research on low-wage work, health benefits, and the effect of labor standards policies. Most recently, I served on the research teams to assess the prospective impact of the minimum wage laws in Seattle and Los Angeles, and carried out the recent study on the public cost of low-wage work. So thanks for inviting me today. This morning, I want to talk about some of the trends in income inequality in Oregon, with a specific focus on what's happening with low-wage workers, discuss our research on the public cost, and get a little bit into causes and policy solutions. So, income inequality has risen sharply in Oregon and the rest of the United States since the late 1970s. While earnings rose at a strong pace at the top, the median wage in Oregon, adjusted for inflation, was 5% lower in 2014 than in 1979. And the largest declines were in the bottom third of the workforce, which is where I'm going to focus much of my talk. If we add in benefit costs to the equations, wages at the median have essentially been stagnant, while productivity rose sharply, about 141%. And basically, since the late 1970s, we've seen this strong divergence where gains to economic growth are being shared less and less evenly. And I'll get back to why in a few minutes. So first, in terms of trends for low-wage workers, for the purpose of this presentation, I'm defining low-wage work as less than two-thirds of the median wage, or $13.30 an hour in Oregon. For a full-time worker, that's $26,600 a year, though most earn much less. Low-wage workers in Oregon, as in the rest of the U.S., are both older and more educated than at any time in the past. In 1979, 18% of low-wage workers were teenagers. By 2014, only 5% were teenagers. And the median age for low-wage workers in the state is 32. Nearly half of low-wage workers in Oregon are married, 47%. 41% have children, and 17.4% are single parents. That's higher than for the workforce as a whole. In 1979, 62% of low-wage workers in Oregon had a high school education or less. By 2014, that had fallen to 43%. That means 57%, over half, have at least some college education, and 15% have a bachelor's degree or higher. And that raises an important point in thinking about ways to address income inequality and low-wage work, because while education and training are vitally important, in and of themselves, they won't solve this problem. In fact, the median wage for workers with a bachelor's degree has fallen in the last decade. The relative returns to education are quite real because the decline in wages for people with less education is even greater. Another way to look at that is, according to the State of Oregon Employment Department, of the 653,000 job openings expected from 2012 to 2022, only 216,000 have some post-secondary education as the level most workers need to enter the occupation, while the remaining 437,000 have high school education or less as the typical education needed for entry, which also suggests that just economic growth along the patterns we've seen is not going to solve the problems we're addressing. So low-wage work has very real consequences for working families. There's a growing body of evidence finding long-term impacts on the health and educational attainment of children who grow up with stress and poverty. Low-wage workers are much less likely to take sick leave, health benefits, or retirement benefits. And low-wage workers with part-time hours face greater challenges of unpredictable work schedules, which make it difficult to work second jobs, go to school, or cover their children's childcare needs. There's also a cost to the public. When workers don't earn enough to cover the cost of supporting their families, they rely on public assistance programs to make ends meet. So along with declining real wages, the share of workers with employment-based health coverage also fell from 67 to 58% nationally from 2003 to 2013. So the issue is both declining real wages and declining benefits. In our recent report, which you have, we estimate that nearly three-quarters of those enrolled in public assistance programs in America are in working families, with a total cost of $153 billion a year. And this is just restricted to looking at food stamps, to needy families, cash assistance, Medicaid, the children's health insurance programs, and our income tax credits. When we look by occupations, we find that 52% of fast food workers in America rely on public assistance programs for their families. That holds true both when we're looking at all the workers and part-time workers, and we just look at full-time workers. Nearly half of child care workers and home care workers, the same. And one of the more surprising findings, 25% of part-time college faculty rely on public assistance to make ends meet, which illustrates some of the important points. These are people with a master's degree or even a PhD, but as we've seen, jobs that used to be regular full-time jobs, tenured, have more and more switched to this adjunct positions where people are piecing together full-time jobs in different places with a high degree of instability, and as a result, 25% rely on public assistance programs. In Oregon, we estimate that about $1.5 billion of the $2.3 billion spent on these four programs goes to assist working families, and the cost of the state government, just looking at the Oregon's share of costs for Medicaid and TANF for working families, is about $267 million a year. So, in thinking about solutions, it's helpful to look at how did we get here, and part of that is globalization and technological change, and that was especially true in the 80s and 90s as we saw the decline in manufacturing. But as we go up in more recent years, what we're finding is the decline in wages is more concentrated within occupations and within industries rather than between, or the change in the mix. And that suggests that what's really happening here is decreased bargaining power for workers. And there's a number of reasons for that. Part of that is the declining value of the minimum wage. Part of it is the declining share of workers in unions, workers under a collective bargaining agreement. Another aspect is the fissured workplace, jobs where when you had more vertical integration within a firm, there were firm norms that led to some wage compression. And as we've seen more contracting out, that has led to a reduction in wages. And we see that with jobs like janitors and security guards, or very heavily at our airports with jobs that used to be done directly by the airlines, then were contracted out to airline service firms at much lower wages, and in some cases, very dramatic reduction. We've also, another aspect of this is federal policies that don't put a high priority on full employment. And this brings us back to Nobel Prize winning economist Joe Stiglitz famously said, inequality is a choice. This is a result of public policy choices. So when we start to look at and think about solutions and how do we address this, it's clear that it requires a mix of strategies, including both a robust safety net and measures to improve wages and benefits. So one major step that's being taken by states and now cities around the country to address low-wage work is raising the minimum wage. San Francisco and Santa Fe set local minimum wages in 2004, a little over 10 years ago, and Los Angeles was the latest city yesterday where the city council voted for an increase to $15 an hour by 2020. It's clear that public assistance programs provide an essential safety net, but one of the key points I want to make is that those programs are more efficient when combined with strategies to improve wages. For example, there have been a number of recent studies that have found that the earned income tax credit reduces wages, both for those who qualify for the credit and for lower income single adults who do not qualify. And part of that is because EIDC brings more workers into the labor market, wages go down. About one-third of the increased income is passed on to employers through reduced wages. Which that suggests is that the EIDC is much more efficient and effective if it's combined with a higher minimum wage. And I think that this is true as well when we look at TANF, where the state has a share of costs on those programs, if wages are higher, more funds can be dedicated, say, in the area of childcare, which is essential in terms of enabling people to work. So when thinking about those solutions, one of the issues that comes off is, well, what about the employment effects of minimum wage, right? If you raise wages, will you end up with more people unemployed who therefore need more public assistance? Well, there's a large body of evidence that's found that minimum wage increases of the size we've seen in the United States to date have not had measurable effects on employment. And this is, there's an incredible number of studies done over the last 20 years that have looked at these issues, comparing what's happened in states where the minimum, counties in states where the minimum wage has increased compared to the counties right across the border where the minimum wage hasn't increased, for example, Spokane, Washington, to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and you look at what's happened to restaurant employment, and they're not finding measurable effects on employment. That's also true in the city case of San Francisco to the surrounding counties. So then the question is, well, why is that? And part of this is there's a sort of naive view of labor costs or what happens here in terms of supply and demand, right? You raise the cost of labor, so demand goes down. But it's important to know that labor is not just a commodity like other commodities. If you increase the price of this pen is going to write the same way it would have written otherwise. But when you pay workers more, performance changes. What we found from the research evidence is that worker turnover goes down. People stay on the jobs longer. Part of that is greater commitment to the job, and part of that is low-wage workers have barriers to staying in employment. Your car breaks down, or you can't afford gas, you miss work, greater absenteeism, that can affect your ability to stay in the job. We also see improvements in worker performance. We did a survey at the San Francisco International Airport a little over 10 years ago, after a mandated wage increase at the airport, and the employers reported better worker performance, better customer service, less grievances, less absenteeism, better equipment maintenance, less equipment damage, so in a whole host of areas. And both reductions in turnover and improvements in worker performance save firms money. That's less cost in hiring, training, and of course the lost productivity. And we estimate that about 20% of the cost of an increased minimum wage is absorbed in that way. One of the areas it's absorbed is through price. When all the firms in an area have to follow the same rules, they are able to pass some of that on into higher prices. And so here we see some increase in price, mainly in the restaurant industry, because that's both low wage and high labor share of cost. And there, every 10% increase in the minimum wage leads to about a 0.7% increase in restaurant prices. These are modest increases. And so that is passed on, again, in very small one-time increases to consumers. And then the last part is low-wage workers, when they have more money in their pockets, they spend that in the local economy, and that has a multiplier effect. And so that also has a positive economic effect. And it's important to note that low-wage workers live in low-income neighborhoods and tend to spend more of their money in those low-income neighborhoods, which is good for the businesses in that area. So as a result, minimum wage laws of the size studied to date in the United States have been shown to be an effective policy to improve income for low-wage workers without affecting employment. And so just to close out, I want to return back to a point I made previously, is that inequality is a choice, and there are solutions. But effective solutions will involve a mix of policies designed to both raise wages and address the other causes and consequences of a low-wage economy. So, thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate your comment. Could you repeat one statistic for me? You mentioned the restaurant wage increase of 10%, and that was correlated with price increase.
Yeah, price increase of about 0.7%. So, for example, we estimated that in San Francisco, bringing up the minimum wage to $15 an hour in 2018 would result in about a 2.5% price increase, or another 25 cents on a $10 hamburger. In San Francisco's, yeah.
Okay, great. I just want to make sure I heard that statistic correctly. Representative Kinnemer, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you. I had a question about this raising of the minimum wage. I guess as I'm listening to your comments, I'm thinking until recently we were the second highest minimum wage in the United States. I guess now, just recently, we're the third.
And yet we seem to be lagging dramatically. So I'm wondering what that says about your thinking about the increase in the minimum wage filtering down and resulting in more jobs.
Well, I want to be clear. Just to say, the increase in the minimum wage doesn't – what we'd expect from minimum wage increases is neutral impact on employment. So you've got – when prices go up a little bit, that results in a little bit less demand, which you'd normally expect to reduce employment, but those workers are spending money in the local economy, and that counteracts that, so that brings the employment back. And in the end, it all it balances out. And so we have looked, my colleagues looked at across the country over 16 years, every time there's been a different minimum wage across state borders and what's the effect on employment, and can find no statistically significant effect. There's really no measurable effect on employment, but they do see very real improvements for low-wage workers. And so the point there is that minimum wage is an effective policy to improve incomes for low-wage workers. It is not enough. I mean, one, there's a question of how high you need to, raising the minimum wage higher, which has a positive impact on workers' earnings. And we're seeing more states now. California is considering $13 an hour. Some others are considering $12 an hour. Patty Murray's proposed 12 nationally. Like I said, LA has just passed 15 by 2020. So we're seeing proposals now to raise the minimum wage more, but that does need to be combined with other strategies. In many of the areas where we're looking at high housing costs, so addressing issues of housing is extremely important. So minimum wage on its own cannot solve these problems.
Thank you. Representative Widener, another question.
Yeah. Just listen to it. I wonder, when you did your study, did you see a decline in the hiring of, like, young high school, college-age students with the minimum wage going up? Or did you look into that at all, a decline in just hiring of people to take care of little things? Because lots of times during the summer, there's businesses that will bring on high school students to do work or college students to do work just to kind of help out with the process. And I'm just wondering if you saw a decline in the hiring of college-age students when you increase the minimum wage?
So that's a good question. There's been a number of studies that have looked specifically at teenage employment. Some of the studies have found no measurable effect on employment. Some studies have found a very small negative effect, and others have actually found a small increase in teenage employment. So there doesn't seem to be a large effect here in that area.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken, I didn't hear you, maybe you did, but make a distinction between service jobs and manufacturing jobs. And if we raise minimum wage and manufacturing jobs start to leave, what does that do to the economy in that regard?
That's a very good question. I mean, the vast majority of low-wage jobs are service jobs that are more place location specific, like janitors and security guards and retail and restaurant workers. Around the question of manufacturing, I think there you really need to look at what is the manufacturing in your state, what are those wages. When we look in California, most of the manufacturing jobs that are retained are in fact are a bit higher wage. They're not the low wages we see in the service sector. There are still some low-wage manufacturing jobs. Los Angeles still has a very small garment industry that's retained. And so those are the kinds of things you have to look at and balance out in making these decisions, because that is an area where you could potentially see some effect, depending on the size of the wage increase. But the other thing that's important is in manufacturing, wages are a smaller share of overall operating costs. And so it's important when you look at this in any particular industry to look at, okay, what are wages now? What's the range of what those wages are? And if you were to raise the wages, what does that do to the overall operating costs? And what we found in terms of looking at this in Los Angeles was the overall increase was actually, as a share of costs in terms of what that would mean to price, was very, very small.
Got a follow-up?
Yeah, one more follow-up.
Okay. Well, I guess I have a whole bunch of questions, but one of the other ones was you said minimum wage increases have not shown much effect on an economy, but those primarily were small increases. In Oregon here, we're talking about a 35% increase, which is fairly substantial, and I would think that would have, in my opinion, a disastrous effect on our economy.
So there have been a range in the size of increases that have been studied. In fact, Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is one city, raised their minimum wage by quite a bit more than that in terms of a percent increase. But the kinds of metrics that you want to look at are it's both the overall size of the wage increase, the share of workers that are impacted by the wage increase, what the overall effect on operating costs in the economy is, and one of the measures we look at is minimum wage in relationship to the median wage. At its height in the United States in 1968, that was 55%. That has gone down quite a bit. Internationally, we see as high as Europe is mostly around in the 50 range, but goes as high as 60. So there are a number of metrics you can look at to say what's the capacity of the economy to absorb the higher minimum wage. But there is, from our research and looking at what's been done, I think there is quite a bit of room to go higher than states have gone to date.
Okay, thank you. Can I ask one more quick question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. One of the things that, or you mentioned a couple of things, globalization and that effect, also automation. You didn't cover immigration, and I wonder how much that has an effect.
There's been a lot of research on the effect of immigration on the economy and you know, in terms of most of them looking at how does immigration affect non-immigrants workers' wages, and that research has found that that they don't find a negative effect on non-immigrant workers' wages from immigration. Part of that is because immigrants are coming in and creating new industries, but also contributing back into the economy. So that doesn't seem to be a large impact again on the overall what the overall workforce is earning.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobs. I appreciate we're going to have to move on with our agenda, and I appreciate you making yourself available through our technology this morning. And I appreciate that you also, we do have on OLIS, which is our information system, a copy of your research brief. If we think of more questions for you, we may, in fact, send you an email, and hopefully you would find time in your day to respond to us. That would be something we could appreciate.
460 pages?
Feels pretty within limits, right?
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much again. And you're welcome to stay on the line if you wish, or disconnect and move on with your busy life in the Berkeley area.
I'm going to have to go, but thanks so much. Take
All right,
care.
Thank you. Let's continue with Sheila Martin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming down to participate in this meeting. And if you just identify yourself before you give your presentation, that'd be great.
Good morning, Chair Hulvey, members of the committee. My name is Sheila Martin. I'm the director of the Institute of Portland Metropolitan Studies and the Population Research Center at Portland State University. The Institute conducts policy research, curates data about our region, and gathers policymakers together to discuss important issues about our region. The Population Research Center conducts a wide variety of demographic research about Oregon, including the population estimates that you rely on to distribute funding throughout the state and population forecasts for all kinds of entities, including city-county coordinated forecasts program and school enrollment forecasting throughout the state. So, I appreciate your invitation, and today I'm going to talk with you about three different things. First, I'm going to define self-sufficiency according to the way it's been defined in the study that we're using. Second, I'm going to talk about what families in Oregon have adequate income and which do not have adequate income. And third, I'm going to talk about what this means for public policy. We don't do any advocacy, but I will give you some things to think about in terms of policy options that you might have to address both the cost side and the income side of the equation. So first, what is self-sufficiency? People throw out a lot of terms like living wage jobs, family wage jobs, but it's not always very clear what they mean by that. And the self-sufficiency standard was developed by the University of Washington Center on Women's Welfare in part to provide a clear definition of what it means for a family to be able to get by, make ends meet without any public or private support.
Master's degree plus 45 hours.
And really, that means taking a look at each specific family type and what their costs are. So let's take a look at this family. This is a fictitious family of four. I think they're all models, actually. two adults and one infant and a preschooler. Let's suppose they live in Medford. If you were to ask the question, how much money does this family need to earn to make ends meet? Just their basics, not any extras, and no public or private subsidies, that is what we mean by the self-sufficiency standard. So the self-sufficiency standard is built the same way a family would build their budget. The cost of housing, childcare, food, transportation, and health care are all figured in. Because we assume that both adults work, they both need transportation, and all children that are younger than teenage need childcare, full-time childcare, part-time if the child is in school. So as you can see, these basic costs don't include any extras like restaurant meals or takeout or vacations, no savings, no recreation, no debt repayment. This is really just the basics. And here I've laid out the costs that are included in developing the self-sufficiency wage for this family of four for two people. So in Jackson County, the self-sufficiency wage for this family is $56,622. So there's a lot of... because the self-sufficiency standard builds in the cost for a household based on where they live and the number and ages of people in the family, it's very different from what the poverty standard sets out. The poverty standard was developed in 1959 based on a low-cost food plan and a whole lot of an assumption that most families at that time spent about a third of their income on food. And, you know, that's just simply not true anymore. It is adjusted for inflation, and it varies by family size, but it does not vary by geography or by ages of children. So the difference here is that the self-sufficiency standard includes all of the basic costs. It varies by size of family and age of children, and it varies by location. So the federal poverty level in 2014 for a family of four was $23,850, much less than what we saw for what our family of four required in Medford. Now, I know this is a difficult slide to digest, but I wanted you, there are a couple of things that I wanted you to see. I've put on this slide the counties that I thought you would care about. Of course, we care about the whole state, but I want you to notice, first of all, how much it costs to have a child, especially a young child. Costs of daycare have gone up quite a bit. And right now in Multnomah County, center-based child care is about $1,400 a month for an infant.
That's the worst decision I ever made.
So I want you to notice also that basic costs vary a great deal throughout the state, and that the federal poverty standard for a family of four doesn't provide adequate income for any place in the state. And in most cases, the cost for this family of four is over two times the federal poverty level and three times the standard.
Chair Holby, can we ask questions?
Yeah, I'd like her to finish her presentation, then can come back to it if that's okay.
Sure. So you can imagine that there are a lot of people, a lot of families in our state that will make more than the federal poverty level but less than the self-sufficiency standard. And those folks fall into what I call the policy gap. They're not considered poor, but they aren't making enough money to make ends meet or even meet their basic costs. So now that we know what the self-sufficiency standard is, what do we know about where families in Oregon fall in comparison to the self-sufficiency standard? So what we did in order to answer this question is we took data from the American Community Survey, and we sorted all the individuals in a special file that we use to do this kind of work into households. So we sort them into households, and we identify the household type. The standard uses 152 family types in order to calculate what that type of family needs. And so we sort those all into the households. We identify which type of household they are, like two adults, three children, what the children's ages are, and so on. And then we match that against what the self-sufficiency standard is for that county and that household type. So then we sort them into three groups. There's a group of households that fall above the self-sufficiency standard, a group of households that have enough income to be above poverty but not high enough to be self-sufficient, and then the final group of households that are considered poor according to the federal poverty standard. So statewide, 37% of families aren't making enough money to meet the self-sufficiency standard, and 19% fall into what I call the poverty gap, the policy gap. So the percentage varies across the state, and the highest percentages are in Multnomah County. Some of the percentages that you see here, Lane County has a very high percentage, and it's gone up quite a bit over the past few years. Since 2008, the percentage not meeting the standard has risen from 27% across the state to 37%. And those increases were especially high in the states that are highlighted in red. And that really is, as we heard earlier, due to both stagnant wages but also increased costs. So this is the average of costs statewide, 16% in childcare, 11% in housing, 11% in transportation, and 27% in healthcare. And as we just heard, wages have been stagnant. In some parts of the state, costs have gone up much more than that. So in the metro area, for example, housing costs have gone up quite a bit. Daycare costs have gone up quite a bit. And in Lane County, all of those costs have gone up an average of 44%. So this chart tells us a lot of things, so give me just a minute to explain it. On the bottom axis is education level, and the vertical axis is the percentage of people meeting the self-sufficiency standard, and not meeting the self-sufficiency standard, excuse me. And then each line represents a different group of folks. So we're looking here at white men, white non-Hispanic men, white non-Hispanic women, minority men, and minority women. And these are the folks who are the heads of the household that we're talking about. So what this shows us, first of all, is that for all education levels, households headed by a minority female have the highest percentage of not meeting the self-sufficiency standard. And while greater education reduces the chance that you won't be able to meet that standard, the gap falls the greater your education is. So we heard earlier that education is really important for getting people out of low-wage work. There are still a number of people with bachelor's degrees that cannot meet their household's needs. So for a minority female, making ends meet requires a much higher level of education than for a white male. And their returns to education are much higher because that gap closes. So this chart is what I call my myth buster. It points out Of all of the households that aren't meeting the self-sufficiency standard, what are their characteristics? So 75% of them are headed by a white person. So even though what I just showed you was that households headed by minority females are much more likely to not meet the self-sufficiency standard, there are a number of people who, 75% of the households who don't meet the standard are headed by a white person. A large percentage of them have no children, even though children are very expensive. Many households that don't meet the standard do not have children. 20% of them are single mothers. 17% have a bachelor's degree or higher. So just like we heard, education does not guarantee that you will meet your family's needs. And 94% of them do not receive any cash assistance, and 35% own their own homes. So this is just gives you a perspective that, you know, really there are lots of families around us that are like many of us, but they still can't make ends meet. So what does this mean for public policy? Before we think about that, I want to bring it back to the family that I showed you earlier and think about what this could mean for them. It means that if both of those workers have good jobs, they are able to make ends meet. So a K-8 teacher and a phlebotomist, that's the person who takes your blood when you go to the doctor and have a blood test, together their income meets the needs for their family. But there are lots of other combinations of jobs where two full-time workers cannot make ends meet. So a tile setter and a nursing assistant is an example I showed here. A locksmith and a veterinary assistant, even full-time work in those professions by two workers will not earn them enough money to make ends meet just for the basics. So what are some communities doing to balance income and costs for working families? There's three things I'd like you to think about. First of all, don't forget that people who aren't poor are not necessarily making ends meet. So even though the percentage that are officially poor is lower, there are still a lot of folks falling into what I call that poverty gap, that policy gap. Second, work systems, which actually sponsored us to do this study, they are using the standard to show people, first of all, what kind of family do you have? Let's figure out how much money you need in order to provide for your family. Then let's take a look at what kind of job will pay the wage that you need, and then let's figure out what kind of training programs you need in order to qualify for that job. So customizing a person's path to where they need to be is one way that we can use this information. And third, there's the cost side of the equation, and we're going to hear about that later in the agenda today. There are lots of ways that people that don't have enough money make ends meet. So they use relatives for childcare. They find less expensive ways to get to their jobs to reduce the cost of transportation. They might double up and, have multiple families living in the same house. But we should also think about other ways, other policies that we're passing that might allow us to reduce the cost of these different expenses for families. One example is transportation. How easy is it for people to get to work without having to own and operate a vehicle, which is very expensive? So thank you for inviting me. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Real quick on your self-sufficiency definition, did that family of four have in its cost of self-sufficiency anything going in for retirement besides Social Security?
No.
Okay, thanks. I think Representative Evans had a question.
Yes, thank you for this. I guess I'm trying to get my mind wrapped around the only policy option that wasn't offered was one person at home and one person working. And I guess I'm trying to figure out, in the federal definition, is the federal definition of poverty of a family of four have both working as well?
It's not dependent on that.
Okay, because at some point it seems that the cost of childcare and transportation alone almost outweighs the income of a person coming in. I mean, that
may be true for many families, and they may decide to make that choice.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kinnear?
Yeah, please. Thank you. Just kind of a comment following up about
the cost of childcare and some of those other issues. It's interesting, in my extended family, not too long ago, and it's sort of tied into Representative Evans' comment, we had a family where she was working in a modest-paying job, I think about $13 an hour, but it was not close to home, and it was reduced from 40 to 30 hours a week, and they had two preschool children. And when they did a careful analysis of their budget, they found out that her quitting her job was a net gain. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was very fascinating to realize how all those expenses added up. I mean, the daycare was astronomical, and then you maintenance and fuel and car and more clothing, more eating out, lots of incidental expenses that you pick up. It was really fascinating to learn that they were actually going to be better off with her not working, not to mention that in terms of their family, it seemed like a better solution.
Yeah, and unfortunately, lots of families don't have that option because they only have one worker.
Mm-hmm. So we have an hour to go without questions.
Mm-hmm. Representative Barreto was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the last speaker, I asked him about the distinction between service jobs and manufacturing jobs, and I noticed Washington County up here had the highest cost of living. And in that county, I think you have Intel, you also have Nike, you know, two of the premier industries in Oregon. And my thought has always been we need to create more jobs in order to offset, you know, the low wages, not artificially just raise those wages. And so when also in the end, when you mentioned land use policies, you mentioned land use in reflecting housing, but land use also affects other industries, sustainable industries like logging or even mining. And so these are job creating things that I feel we need. I think that the things that you presented here are real, but the solutions, I feel, are jobs. And when I asked the last speaker about immigration, because we have an influx of immigrants that are low-wage workers that come up and take those low-wage jobs, it still comes back to supply and demand in the workforce that raises the wages. So more comment than question, but if you want to add to that, that'd be great.
Oh, that was a lot. yes, costs in Washington County are very high, and there are a lot of high-wage jobs in Washington County. There are also a lot of people working in Washington County that don't earn, that don't work at Intel and Nike, that don't, you know, there are a large percentage of families that don't meet the self-sufficiency standard.
Sure. And a lot of those, if I may add a comment, are service jobs.
Well, we do have an agenda left to do.
I'm good now.
So, and I'd like to get on with the rest of the agenda. I mean, you can get your questions, and we'll try to filter them back to people to answer them. But I don't want to cut the other presenters short because I think they, Representative Widener, a really quick question.
Just really quick. I'm just wondering, when you went through the study, you looked at if you just set a base salary of everybody makes $30,000 a year or $60,000, and where you had two choices and got rid of the wage gap and setting minimum wages and everything else, and everybody just made the same wage. Have you looked at any doing studies like that at all?
I think what you're asking me is what would happen if everyone met the self. I'm not sure I understand your question.
So you just paid everybody $30,000 a year if you're in this industry, and if you work in this industry, everybody makes $60,000 a year. That's just your salary. So that way, everybody's equal, same playing field. Have you done any studies of doing something like that?
No, we haven't. We haven't looked at what would happen if everyone was making the same. I can't imagine. I mean, it sounds like nothing
it's communism,
resembling socialism. What we have.
Well, thank you. With that question, I think we're going to let you go back and ponder that, as we will too, probably. I appreciate your testimony this morning. It's very interesting work that you do. Up next, I have Claire Seguin. Claire Seguin, Rosa Klein. Belit Burke and Rhonda Prudzinski. Jeez.
Speaking of education. Oh, excuse me. Those are.
It's tough.
Someday your eyesight will be bad.
I wear something.
I just walked in. I was like, there's no name tag for me. All right. I'll go punish
Good morning. If whoever's going to go first could introduce themselves.
Great, Sam.
Good morning, and thank you for being here.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Belit Burke. I am the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program Manager for Department of Human Services.
So you can go ahead and if you're going to present, then they can introduce themselves when they present.
Okay.
That'd be great.
So we're going to talk about the public assistance for working poor and how our sets of services work together. So a little different perspective, but in the same vein of what is what we've been watching this morning. So our overview is we'll talk about poverty in Oregon and our set of Oregon Safety Net programs. Talk about programs for working low-income Oregonians, and then we'll start with housing and community services, then we'll go back to Department of Human Services, and then finish with health authority, and then hopefully be able to answer some questions. So the poverty rate remains high, as you've heard earlier. Many of the folks we're serving are still, they're working, but they're still in poverty.
And before you go any further, are you using the federal poverty standard as defining poverty?
Yes, we are. And the climate of poverty is challenging. We've stolen this slide from, or borrowing it from Echo Northwest, but this is an example of folks and the incomes they're receiving with the same set of services that you see listed up here, which is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is formerly the Food Stamp Program, Women's Infants and Children, Temporary Assistance for Needy Family and Child Care Subsidy Programs. Children and their parents compose almost 60% of Oregon's in poverty. And so you can see from the chart where the children are, where the childless, disabled, and poverty are, and et cetera. I'm not going to spend too much time on our slides. You've had a lot of information this morning.
And then we'll hand off it there. Good morning. I'm Claire Seguin, and I'm the Assistant Director of Housing Stabilization at Oregon Housing and Community Services. And in my role there, I oversee our homeless services programs. I oversee our energy and weatherization programs, the individual development account program, and the HUD contract administration. And I'm here to share with you a little bit more detail about the programs that we offer to the Oregonians we all care so much about. Oregonians in poverty follow a pathway, and what we all try to provide collectively is the pathway from making families secure and safe all the way through total stability. And so all of our programs are designed to meet people somewhere along that pathway over time based on the needs that we can help them identify and the resources that we have to offer. We believe strongly that housing is a foundational part of that equation, and so our programs, in partnership with everybody else, we believe help set the groundwork for families to become secure first so that the other services that everybody else provides will be more effective. We know that when people have a place to live, the kids do better in school, they're healthier, all of those things begin to fall into place. So we believe that the continuum of housing services to provide stability is an essential part of this equation. We often talk about housing as a continuum in our organizations. And basically, we offer every kind of program that we can come up with to directly benefit people from homelessness. And you can see a list here of the types of things that we work on, to rental housing, and then ultimately to home ownership, because we also believe that home ownership is an important part of the housing equation for a good and stable state of Oregon. So we want to be sure that we can provide services all along the way. In order to do our work, we have a definition of affordable, and we want to share with you a way that we calculate that. We stand behind the definition that paying 30% of your income towards rent is considered affordable. What we want to make sure is that you have enough money left over so that you can pay for child care, health care, some of the other things we heard from the other presenters. The basic needs need to be covered in addition to your housing, and at 30%, that's how you can do that. We know that an Oregonian, someone earning minimum wage, would have to work 72 hours a week to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment at average rents. That's $864 a month. And this is assuming, of course, that the worker's not going to spend more than 30% of their income. And what we also know, sadly, is that nearly one in three Oregonians pay more than 50% of their income towards rent, which you know means they're not buying something else they probably need. And one in two pay more than 30% of their income towards rent. So we definitely have some challenges there. I also wanted to point out to you all something that I think we're all feeling acutely recently. We know that we don't have enough housing that is affordable really anywhere in the state. It's sort of a crisis that we're all trying to work through, I think, together. But what we know is that 175,000 renter households in Oregon are considered extremely low income, and we only have 45,000 rental units affordable to those folks. That's a lot of people who can't afford to be housed. We also know that only one in four eligible households receive federal housing subsidy nationwide, and we saw some other statistics about that from the previous speakers. So what OHCS tries to do is put together some programs that combined help reduce that burden and help to get people to where they need to be along our continuum. So we have homeless prevention services, energy assistance, weatherization, rental housing, and home ownership. Most of the services that we provide for housing stabilization are delivered through Community Action Partners. It's a network, an amazing network of 17 agencies that cover every county across the state, and they provide these services to the folks in their communities because they are the closest to the need. They understand where the investments are best realized, and then they can coordinate the programs and funding to get it to the folks who need it the most. Under homeless prevention, we have two different primary programs. We have the Emergency Housing Account and the State Homeless Assistance Program, and you can see some of the programs that are provided through those funding sources. In FY 2014, over 5,000 folks were served. Very impactful work there. The energy assistance and weatherization programs provide energy payments. They help weatherization on homes so that people's energy costs are lowered. And they, too, serve thousands, tens of thousands of people throughout the state with these programs. Again, incredibly impactful and important part of our equation to help people's costs keep lowered so that they can stay in their homes. The next program I wanted to touch on is the Oregon IDA initiative. This is the individual development account. This is OHCS's strategy to help build assets. We believe that home ownership, for example, is a perfect example of an asset. Some of our lower income Oregonians need help to get there. We work with them through counseling, education, and a matched savings program so that families can dream a dream, work together to achieve a plan and reach their goal and ultimately stabilize their family. It might be education, it might be business, might be home ownership. We've got some other smaller types of investments, but those are the three that most commonly our families focus on to try to bring stability to their families. And we have our multifamily housing program. You can see here from the map generally where we've been working. We do about 1,300 units of development per year that we help fund. And we have done, in the last 5 years, 7,888 units in 222 projects in 31 counties. That's a lot. So we believe that building housing units, of course, is an essential part of the crisis and the equation that we have right now, trying to get people into homes. And then finally, the last program that I wanted to touch on is homeownership assistance. And this is through our regional housing centers. We offer foreclosure counseling and avoidance. We offer first-time home buyer counseling. We have down payment assistance. And we are reaching Oregonians who might not ever have the chance to do that through these programs. As an agency, we're committed to our partners and to sharing a strategy to help Oregonians become more stable and to move along this continuum to prosperity. And we work hard at it every day, but we have a lot to do. I appreciate your time, and I'm here for questions.
Thank you.
So it's back to Department of Human Services. And so we have a set of services that, again, they work with the different services that are provided. Families come to us in different places in their lives. We provide food benefits, cash assistance, refugee services, childcare. Nutrition education is a component of the food program. So we offer some nutrition education with those benefits. Family stability services, which really a lot of the folks that we serve that need the cash assistance program are, they need to have their family stabilized so that they can move off of cash assistance and into employment. Employment services are offered through both the food program and through the temporary assistance to needy families program. And then we have the domestic violence services as well.
And good morning, committee, Chair Holby and other members. My name is Rhonda Prudzinski. I'm the Child Care and Refugee Program Manager at Department of Human Services. And this slide shows the percent of county population receiving at least one self-sufficiency program service in 2014. So you can really see the impact that our programs have on communities. Wanted to just share our program income limits. The monthly income limits for the employment-related daycare program and SNAP for a family of three, the income eligibility limit is 185% of the federal poverty level. So that would be $3,099. Excuse me. For the temporary assistance for needy families program, the income limit is $616, and the limit for our families is at the 37% of the federal poverty level, so it's much lower. Focusing on a continuum of services, DHS serves thousands of Oregonians each year, and our assistance programs really focus on a continuum of services aimed at stabilizing and strengthening families to become self-sufficient. And this is done by connecting families to stability services and reducing barriers to employment and preparing families for work. First, I wanted to just share a little bit about the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. The program currently serves over 28,000 families, and these are families with children in extreme poverty. And the program provides them with family stability and employment services. The TANF program helps families meet their basic daily needs. We help parents remove a variety of barriers that interfere with getting a job and also keeping a job. Build skills that get people hired through basic skills training, work experience, and subsidized employment. The program connects families to other programs to improve their stability and employment prospects. It provides intervention for families at risk of entering the child welfare system. The participants in the TANF program in 2004, over 14,000 of those individuals ended up getting jobs. Now I wanted to share just a little bit about the opportunities for TANF, especially with House Bill 3535. It's a combination of policy changes and a targeted reinvestment strategy, and it directs $30 million into the TANF program. It reduces the number of participants affected by the benefits cliff when they become employed. It simplifies eligibility requirements to strengthen family connections and stability for children. It expands family stability services, increases flexibility and support services to prevent families from entering TANF. It improves program capacity to provide strength-based, customized, and outcome-focused case management. With its dual purpose of protecting children and helping parents join the workforce, TANF represents a unique opportunity to leverage Oregon's promising education and employment-focused initiatives. Employment factors and caseload funding trends allow for a unique, cost-neutral opportunity to strengthen the program's impact and, in partnership with other systems and nonprofits, to achieve the goals of safety, stability, and prosperity for Oregon's families. And next, we have the employment-related daycare program. And I just wanted to share a little bit of information about our child care program. The ERDC employment-related daycare program helps low-income working families pay for child care so parents can retain employment. It also focuses on focusing healthy child development and school success, helping to break the poverty cycle for the next generation. The number of TANF families transitioning to ERDC has risen substantially this last year. More families are finding work, and child care is crucial for retaining these jobs. ERDC families have access to quality child care. Our caseload cap for the program is at currently 7,800 families. At the beginning of the biennium, the average caseload was projected at 8,500. During the biennium, our expenses increased, and this was mainly due to more families choosing quality licensed child care. In October of 2014, the average caseload cap needed to be adjusted to 7,800 families, and our reservation list was implemented. Currently, over 3,300 families are waiting for child care. For the ERDC program, parents must pay a portion of the child care cost called copay. DHS makes payments directly to the approved child care provider. We have over 4,000 providers caring for subsidy kids. Most of these are small businesses. Providers employed by ERDC parents are contributing members to local economies throughout the state. DHS payments to ERDC providers total over $5.8 million each month. Whoops, I went too far. There we go. So we do have opportunities for ERDC during this session also. There's two legislative proposals. The first is the governor's recommended budget, and it provides more families access to quality child care. It would increase the caseload from 7,000 to over 10,800 families. DHS is currently able to only serve about 16% of the eligible children in the state. The Speaker's House Bill 2015 makes a big, significant investment and also policy improvements to the employment-related daycare program. This bill would increase the number of families served. It would increase access for self-employed parents, and it would allow working parents to use a child care subsidy to cover both work hours and school hours. This benefits working parents by broadening their options to attend higher education as they work towards self-sufficiency by increasing their opportunities in the employment market. It also would allow for protected eligibility for families for up to 12 months, and this would allow children to remain in stable, quality child care. What we've found with our families, they often go from one low-paying job to another, and this would provide that continuity of care for the child, especially as they go and they do work search and other activities. The bill also provides incentives for quality child care settings. The governor's and Speaker Kotek's proposals make a significant impact to children, the workforce, and child care providers.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about the SNAP program and who we're serving. As you can see, we're serving one in five Oregonians. Currently, as of March, we had over 700,000 people that were being served by the SNAP program. 30% of our caseload is working, so these are folks that are working and not making enough money to be able to leave the SNAP program. The program does expand and contract with the economy, so when we saw the economic downturn in Oregon, we saw the caseload really grow. It is starting to decline now, but it's very slow. This is meant to be a food supplement, but most families try to use this as their whole food budget, so they will try to live on their SNAP allotment and make that work for them for an entire month. Usually that runs out about the third week of the month, and then they go to food pantries and try to fill in their budget there. We do try to encourage them to, you know, use the school lunch program and those kinds of things as well, just so that they can help leverage their benefits. But again, that's something that's only available to them when they're at school. So that's for the children. We also have, you know, you can see that there's an economic multiplier with the SNAP program. So every $1 spent equals an impact of $1.79 in local economic activity. So folks are buying food. They generally don't save their SNAP benefits, and so it goes right back into the economy. 2015 opportunities for the SNAP program. So the SNAP program is mostly federally funded. And so one of the programs that we do have some opportunity with is the Employment and Training Program, which is a 50-50 match. And we have been working with in partnership with nonprofits in the state to try to build our ability to provide employment and training services. So, for example, Goodwill Industries has some employment and training sites. They're using their funding to pull down the federal match and provide employment services to SNAP participants. And so that's, you know, an example of how we're trying to work with the program to increase this. We've been encouraged by Food and Nutrition Services to continue to grow that part of the program and really focus on people who are working but underemployed so that we can help build their skills and get them more fully employed. Last year, in 2014, we received a federal grant, which we used as startup funding for some organizations to be able to provide employment and training services with the agreement that they would transition into a 50-50 program once the grant funding was over. We were one of seven states to receive this grant, and our focus is on veterans and people who have served in the military. So National Guardsmen may not be eligible for some of those veteran services that the, you know, some of the veterans are, and this allows us the opportunity to provide them with some employment services, support services to help them get back into the workforce. And the grant is currently in Lane, Jackson, Josephine, Klamath, and Lake counties. And that is it for Department of Human Services, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Would you like to go ahead?
Sure. Good morning. My name is Rosa Klein. I'm with the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm the Legislative Coordinator for Public Health. So I'm going to talk about two programs today. We have the Oregon Health Plan and the Women, Infants, and Children Program that serve a wide variety of Oregonians and provide basic foundational services in healthcare and nutrition. So the primary program that we provide is the healthcare coverage through the Oregon Health Plan. You've probably heard a lot about the Oregon Health Plan in the last few years due to Medicaid expansion in our state. We've had a really successful expansion of Medicaid here. And then additionally, the Women, Infants, and Children Special Supplemental Nutrition Program is through our Public Health Division. And that program is similar to SNAP, but somewhat different. It's only for pregnant, breastfeeding women, and then children under the age of 5. First, I'll talk about the Oregon Health Plan. Eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan is contingent on the family size and income level and among other factors. So it's primarily income determined. And you can see the different income levels and household size based on the category of applicant or member. We know that for certain caseloads, so we're not including children and some of the other categories of eligibility, that the employment rate is between 35 to 45%, and that is across the spectrum between part-time, occasional, and full-time work. And then, let's see. So we cover over 1 million Oregonians, 1,055,000 Oregonians as of last month. And let's see. So we have, because of the wide number of eligibility categories, I'm essentializing the coverage. But let's see. We have about... if you want to look at the number of children versus adults, we have about adults without children is around 50,000. The newly expanded coverage for adults without children, it grew it up to 95,000. So when we were able to extend Medicaid to more people, more adults without children who are at or below 138% of federal poverty level, we saw that number of uninsured adults decrease. And then if you look at the next slide, you can see the overall Affordable Care Act expansion in our Medicaid program. And you can also see that the benefit for OHP standard was eliminated. So we had one benefit for the adults without children, and then another that was covered more preventive care. It covered there was a more richer dental and vision benefit. There were some kind of essential services and preventive services for people who are looking for work that were covered under the new expansion, and we've eliminated that the OHP standard benefit. Next, for the Women, Infants, and Children program, so this income eligibility for WIC is 185% of federal poverty level, and you can see it's determined also by family size and income. We cover about 100,000 Oregonians, and that includes the women, infants, and children. So that's not 98,000 families, that's individuals. And in addition to the around $53 a month in benefit that's used for food, there's also registered dietitians who work with families to test blood lead levels, test iron. They weigh babies. They provide breastfeeding advice. They have lactation consultants available so that those young families are really able to get the best nutritional start that they can. And the vouchers for WIC are restricted to fruits and vegetables, whole grains, protein. So it's very nutritious food that these families are being provided. I'm happy to take any questions if you have any.
Thank you. I am Representative Noss.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. This is very, very interesting. I'm curious. If we were to raise wages significantly enough that you could actually, you know, earn a living through working and then be meaningfully able to cover your expenses, could we redeploy the services and the things that you're doing to then better serve a more targeted population, or is that not possible?
From the OHA perspective?
General, I guess to all of you, I guess.
Okay. Well, I'll speak. So Rosa Klein from OHA. From the OHA perspective, for these two programs, these are federally funded programs that are specifically dedicating dollars to these services for that income level. So no, we would not. There's some state general fund match, but it's minimal.
Thank you. Representative Widener, or you want to go ahead and answer that question too?
Yeah, I would just say that anything that we can do to help these families raise their family income is going to have an impact into the services that we provide. We may do it differently, we may do less of it, but I would say that yes, that would make an impact.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question, and it's probably more towards human services side, well, actually, and for both sides. I just want to know how many people are going on public assistance each month and how many people are coming off the system each month. So do we have more going on, more going off? How many people are transitioning off of assistance too versus being on it over a long period of time? Because I think SNAP is, well, there's no limit on that, but TANF is like 7 years that they can be on TANF or
five,
something like that. So if you can just give me an idea of what that transition period is and are we increasing or declining?
So Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, what we're seeing right now, I can't give you exact numbers, but we are seeing a decline in both the SNAP caseload and the TANF caseload. The SNAP caseload is going down slowly because folks are going to work, but they're not going to work full time. We have a higher threshold. We go up to 185% of federal poverty level, where you have the TANF program, which is at 37% of federal poverty level. So folks only have to work a little bit when they're receiving TANF, and they lose their TANF benefits. And that's where we had talked about the fiscal cliff. Folks lose their TANF benefits, and then they have a really steep gap with what their income was and where they're, you know, where they're trying to go. So we're seeing the TANF caseload go down. It's gone down quite a bit over the last year. And again, I can't give you the exact numbers. Off the top of my head, I think it was over 13,000 over the last year. So it's, we're really starting to see people come off of the TANF caseload. And the only other thing I would add is when people come into our offices and they apply for benefits, it's generally when they're at their worst moment. They wait, and they wait until they're in crisis before they come in and they apply for SNAP or for TANF benefits. And so they don't want to come in and receive a benefit package from us. We're the last door that they come to. For ERDC, it's a capped program, and so we're just staying level. There's more need than there is ability to provide services.
I guess so. A family of four would be it's $123 a person, so roughly $493 a month is what they would receive for SNAP.
It depends. Chair Holvey, Representative Widener. For the SNAP benefits, it depends on what their income is and if they're receiving shelter or utility. So the benefits don't stay at one benefit level. It really is dependent upon the calculation of what the family circumstances are. So you could have a family of four at 185% of the poverty level receiving a very small benefit, where if they're at 130% of federal poverty level, they're receiving a much bigger benefit.
Just to follow up on those two previous questions, the idea that we have this gap in between self-sufficiency, which we heard about earlier, and the poverty level, which, you know, a lot of your programs have these limits of when you can apply to or receive those benefits, sort of ties in with, you know, how do we address that gap so the people that are going to work, as Representative Kinnemer explained, you know, really see that incentive to keep working because it's actually beneficial to them, whereas this benefit cliffs that you're talking about, that maybe, you know, House Bill 3535 helps address some of this, but that's, where's our flexibility, you know, and that's a question maybe we can follow up with, where's our policy flexibility at the state level in our programs to address that gap so people don't have an incentive to stay in these programs, and actually, you know, when they get jobs at a certain income level, they're able to survive. And I think that's sort of, you know, one of our fundamental questions that we're trying to address. But I'm going to, after having stated that, you don't get a chance to answer it, but unless you do have a quick answer. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of a good segue to actually what I want to comment about too, and I think maybe it's more of a comment than a question, and it relates to what Ms. Sigwin
Does that get that right?
Seguin.
Seguin, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Was talking about down in rules, we have a bill to create a $100 million fund to help create more rental housing. And I'm having a real struggle with that because as I keep looking at this, this is more enabling instead of empowering. We're getting more people dependent on the system. You know, and I'm thinking of my wife, who served for many years on Northwest Housing Alternatives board, and they had a system where people would rent, but they received the equity gains of inflation over time, and that enabled many of them to move out and buy a house. And I just think we need to start getting more creative in these programs. There's a huge need for housing and for people who do not have adequate income. But how do we move that so that they have a future instead of dependence? And I guess I make that more as a comment than a question. I just think that's our goal. Our goal should be self-sufficiency. I grew up in poverty. It wasn't very much fun. And it was a good incentive to do differently. And I think we need to be careful that we help people move in positive directions. And we also have to realize there are some disabled and other folks who cannot. But those that can, we need to figure out how to be moving them forward.
Representative Doherty, do you have a question?
And maybe this will be brought up when the economists come up. But we've talked about TANF and all these programs. But I think one group, especially with housing, that I'm running into more and more that are having really problems are seniors. And the elderly that have no food and don't know how to work the system and so on. So is there at least a move to have some sort of outreach for the seniors? Because a lot of them are living on their Social Security, which is about, some of them, $600 a month.
Chair Holvey and Representative Doherty, I would say that OHCS is looking at that all the time. Mm-hmm. We have several programs to help folks age in place, for example, so that as they age and have different needs in terms of where they live and how they live, they can access funds to do that. So it's top of mind for us as we see the aging population.
Because in our area, in my area, housing is the biggest concern because housing is getting so expensive.
That's right. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate you putting this together for us to kind of give us a flavor for this committee on the benefit side of policies and how that impacts, you know, people who are at the lower levels of income in Oregon. So I appreciate you coming forward this morning, and thank you very much. Up next, we're a little bit behind schedule. I'd like to have Chris Olenek. Good morning. If you'd identify yourself and rifle through your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Olenek, Legislative Revenue Office. And I know you're fighting the clock, and I don't have a presentation. I just have a two-page handout, so I can be very brief. And I was asked to come talk about low-income tax credits. And at a high level, there are two tax credits that exist within the tax system, and I'm kind of merging the federal and the Oregon tax systems together. We have the earned income tax credit, and then we have the consumer child care credits. The earned income credit currently can be up to $6,000 at the federal level, and the Oregon tax credit, the Oregon earned income credit, is a piggyback credit. Ours is just 8% of the federal credit. So combined, that's in 2013, that was an average of around $2,200 in earned income tax credits. For the child care credits, those, as the committee is aware, has been the topic of discussion this session. And under current law, there is a working family child care credit, which is a refundable tax credit. It's an Oregon-only credit, and it is up to 40% of unlimited eligible child care costs. And then we also have the child independent care credit, which is a federal credit and, again, an Oregon piggyback credit. The federal credit is up to 35% of eligible expenses. Those eligible expenses are capped at $3,000 for one dependent or $6,000 for more than one dependent. and that is not phased down. It is, there's a tail on it so that regardless of the income level, there is at least a 20% tax credit. The Oregon Child and Dependent Care Credit is up to 30% of child care expenses, and that is phased out. So it is means tested for Oregon. So on the first page of the handout, I just have some numbers from tax year 2013, and then there's a bar chart showing who claims those tax credits by income level. On the second page, I had a couple of charts to give a flavor of how the tax credits work. So if that's available, the earned income credit phases in, levels off, and then phases out. So it increases as in earned income increases. So there's an incentive to, you get a larger credit if you work more up to a certain level. And then the credit is a fixed percentage for a plateau level, and then it starts to phase down. I don't know if I can.
Do you know how many people in Oregon use these tax credits?
Yes. There are about 260,000 taxpayers claim the earned income credits. 25,000 claim the working family child care credit, and about 60,000 claim the child independent care credits. And one thing on the second page of that chart of the handout is a reflection of the work that was done through Rep. Kenny Geyer's committee in comparing the, there are two charts there. There's a blue line that reflects the incidence of the tax credits.
We're not there. Are you the controller of the PowerPoint, Chris?
It doesn't have internet.
It's on OLA,
so it should be
on.
Okay, I'll look at it.
Okay. And the merged credit, what the work that came out of Rep. Kenny Geyer's committee basically merges the working family child care credit and the child independent care credit into a working family child independent care credit. And the bottom two charts on that second page, there's a blue line that shows current law, the combined net effect of those tax credits, federal and state. So you can see that up to 80% of the child care expenses result in a tax credit. And then there's a red dashed line that shows the merged, the proposed law that is being considered by the legislature right now. And I put them back to back like that because the intent was to largely model the child care credit after the earned income credit, where the value of the credit increases with earned income, and then largely or roughly levels off and then declines as income increases.
So thank you. It appears that this credit actually does sort of help fill in that gap that we were talking about between self-sufficiency and the poverty levels.
That's largely the intent, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
To work to that end, yes.
All right, great. Appreciate that. Questions for Representative Barreto?
Chris, there was a bill earlier, I think, that came through here that was an employer tax credit for child care, and I think it went out of this committee, if I'm not mistaken, but it was sunsetting, I think, this year. Do you know about that or where that's at? Or
Chair Holby, Rep. Barreto, the employer-provided dependent care assistance credit did not make it to JTACs through either the House side or the Senate side. That was the employer-provided. That was the credit that would go to the employer.
Correct. That credit did not move.
In either chamber.
In either chamber. Interesting. At least we're consistent. I appreciate that. And I assume that following up on that tax credit, that money will be potentially available for perhaps the other child care tax credits if the policy and the tax credit committee deems that appropriate.
Effectively, yes, Mr. Chair. JTAX is getting started on the tax credits, yes.
Great. I appreciate that. Thank you very much for coming down and just giving us a brief overview. Up next, I'd like to have Josh Lehner to finish up our informational meeting.
Good
You have the job of wrapping all this up in the big picture.
Of course, my pleasure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lander, Office of Economic Analysis. Happy to be here and talk some of this. Of course, don't have the answers, but talk about some of the economic trends and the budget trends that we're seeing, at least from our office's perspective. We're not a policy shop. We're more of a research shop and a forecasting division, and that's largely where our focus is. One of the things I've been told some of your previous work sessions have talked about are some of these broader trends in the economy. We're having what we call a bifurcated nature of the economy, where a lot of growth at the high end and a lot of growth at the low end of the wage spectrum and types of jobs, but not a lot in the middle. And so the problem is when you lose one of those middle wage jobs, construction worker, plumber, teacher, you know, sales, office, administrative support staff, things like that, and you're not able to replace it. And this happens most pronouncedly during times of economic recessions. And we just went through the largest recession in three generations, and we lost a lot of middle wage jobs, and they're coming back slowly. I'll skip ahead to a graph here, and you can see it more broadly. The middle wage jobs in the red are growing much more slowly than both the high and the low end jobs, both nationwide and in Oregon. Oregon is not an outlier either to the good or the bad when it comes to this process of job polarization and squeezing the middle wage jobs. We're kind of in the middle of the pack, right around the typical state over a business cycle in this regard. The good news here is those middle wage jobs are coming back. The problem is when you can't find one and you're forced to take a low wage job, it's a downgrade in your quality of life, your quality of living, your ability to spend on things for your children or your housing, which is becoming a major problem, and things like that. So even though the outlook's getting a little bit better here, it's still not great. Ideally, you would want the economy to, and the market itself, to improve such that they can pay a living wage to the employers or to the employees. You know, a lot of the economists' labor models and their labor matching models and things like that talk about workers getting paid their marginal productivity to the firm, right? You get paid what you're worth to your business. To the extent that we're having an economy that generates a whole lot of low-wage jobs that aren't up to the poverty level or aren't up to the self-sufficiency level, however you want to define those things, it acts more like, it's not necessarily market failure, but it's something that's happened in the last 30 years in the economy, particularly the last 15 years in the economy, where we're not getting so many jobs in the middle that pay that sustainable living wage, however you want to define that. We're getting a lot of low-wage work, and then also we're getting a ton of jobs at the high end. Of course, there are different skill sets, different educational requirements, and things like that to get it. And this is one of the major things that's going on in the economy, and you guys have been focusing on what are some of the ways to make some of these low-wage jobs better, right? There's a lot of issues with them, whether the geographic mismatch between where people live and where they work, whether they have sick leave and all that sort of stuff. So it's understandable how policymakers would want to focus on making them better. It's hard, again, from a fundamental economic perspective and a modeling perspective, to say ideally, you know, we'd have a stronger economy in which the workers were more productive and the employers were able to pay these living wages. Unfortunately, we haven't seen that particularly in the last 15 years. So since we're seeing the focus on some of the policies in front of your committee, the other good news here from a national perspective is we're starting to see some improvement in low wages, particularly in the last year. And, you know, we've seen the big announcements from Walmart and McDonald's and maybe Target or whatever about raising their starting wages for their employers, but it's across the whole spectrum of low-wage jobs nationally have really seen an uptick in the last year. I don't know how much of it is, you could say, it's public shaming of these corporations for paying such low wages, but there's also been a broader movement. There's a professor at MIT. She has a so-called good job strategy where, you know, you can look at some of these low-wage industries, but certain employers pay better wages, Costco, Trader Joe's, places like that, that have reduced turnover, right? One of the larger costs for some of these low-wage industries is employee turnover and having to retrain people and the like. If you know, Costco and Trader Joe's are two of the prime examples where they pay higher wages. Granted, they're not maybe even up to the self-sufficiency level, but, you know, they're $12, $15 an hour for an industry that typically pays $10 or so. they've seen some success. And those are all employer-driven practices that seem to be starting to spread a little bit more across the industry and across the spectrum. And again, ideally, from an economist point of view in our modeling, that would be the solution. To the extent that that doesn't occur, you can certainly understand the focus on trying to help out some of these low-wage workers and the working poor through some other policies and some other means. Real quickly, to keep us on track and provide some questions, opportunities for some questions moving forward. The other thing I'll talk about job polarization, impacts the rural areas more pronouncedly. The high-wage jobs are disproportionately created in the cities, right? So if you're losing a lot of middle-wage jobs and not adding anything at the high end, it's an unfortunate trend for some of the more rural areas in the state and across the countries. The bigger concern here is the potential economic growth rate. To the extent that people lose a decent, good-paying job, can't find one that replace it, and instead of taking a low-wage job, they just drop out of the labor force and say, I'm not going to work, there's nothing for me. It has the potential to reduce our economic productivity and our economic capacity, both in the state and across the nation. And so while the total number of jobs in Oregon is all the way back to pre-recession levels, our unemployment rate is all the way down to pre-recession levels, we know the economy is not fully healthy. We're starting to see some wage gains, but we have a lower labor force participation rate than we've seen before. Some of it's due to aging, but not all of it's due to the aging of the baby boomers. And so this is the type of stuff that we incorporate, what we just talked about, into our modeling and our outlook, is both, you know, labor force participation rate, the bifurcation of the job market in terms of high wage and low wage jobs, and things like that are the things that our office has focused on. Specifically to some of the things you guys are considering, I would highlight a couple things when it comes to some of these middle wage jobs. Is that a construction worker and a plumber get paid just as much as a teacher. However, their formal education requirements cannot be more different. On the job training programs for some of these, you know, you could consider the blue or the gold standard of the blue collar occupations, constructions and the trades and things like that. Having apprenticeship programs and on-the-job training programs and support things to support these jobs, again, historically has been the best path for people that don't have higher education, at least formally, in terms of the trades. On the lower end of the spectrum, you know, a lot of it is just high school degrees or less, but they are also impacted by the forces of automation in the office place. It's somewhat fitting that the Mad Men series finale was just the other day. The office support staff, the administrative support staff, if you think about that show, if anyone watches it, outside of every single office, there's a secretary, right? You know, office in the 60s and the 70s. You walk into any office today, it doesn't look like that. That is an erosion of a good middle wage job just due to technological change, right? A secretary today has to book travel, has to be able to do some publishing, either it's on the web or making a newsletter, things like that. And these are the things that unfortunately, you know, to the extent, you know, a policy won't fix these changes in the labor market, but it is a lack of middle wage job opportunities where you can transition yourself from, you know, a worse position in the financial spectrum up to a better one. So these are some of the things that are ongoing and that are a challenge in the workplace. Budget pressures, real quickly, there's a difference, you know, sometimes it's misleading in terms of, you know, we have the second highest or the highest SNAP rate usage in the country. You know, our poverty rate is a little above average, but we're right there in the middle of the pack with the poverty. However, our SNAP usage is high. So focusing in on that and saying, look how bad Oregon is in terms of our economy is a little bit misleading. There's a world of difference between Mississippi and Oregon, even though sometimes we rank next to each other on, say, education funding or SNAP usage or things like that. And again, you know, policies that are put in place do impact the usage of these programs, so we can't forget that. In terms of income taxes and the like, of course, the higher income you earn, the more taxes you pay. If you do the rough math on the bottom half of the income spectrum, those making $30,000, $40,000 in adjusted gross income or less, if you just kind of shift them up, you know, just $5,000 each, if we had a stronger economy, better paying jobs, shift them up just a little bit, and then you factor out the retirees, we're talking roughly $100 million in additional revenue a year. $200 million a biennium, obviously, if you do that math, which is what I'm paid to do, and such. So, you know, we're talking real money, stronger economy, better paying jobs. increased tax revenues for the state, and then some of the previous people in front of me talking about lower benefits paid out on the other side. But the benefits cliff is real. What you see in front of you is a graph that came out of some work that the previous speaker, Chris, had done in a draft report from LRO. There's another draft report that is being finalized right now. That's a conjunction of our office with the CFO's office, the budget and management folks, LRO and LFO. I have attended some of the meetings, but I haven't attended all of the meetings. I'm not the one writing the report, so I shouldn't speak to it, the specifics of it. However, it gets at the same issue where ideally all of these need-based programs would be phased out along with income. You know, make it as gradual as possible so you don't create a quote-unquote benefits cliff and the like. And so while the available resources to the households on some of these programs may not change dramatically if we are at a $9 minimum wage or a $12 minimum wage, the amount of money they have available to spend might not be substantially different. The composition of that certainly would. They'd be much better off in terms of their earned income, and then there'd be a reduced cost side on the state budget. And then lastly, in terms of the budget pressures moving forward, this kind of just shows the general fund and the lottery fund spending across some of the major components of it, both as a budget share and then what the population share that kind of the spending is attached to moving forward. You know, the school age population is declining. The college age population is about to decline. The typical millennial is somewhere around 23, 24 years old today. So that's going to start dropping off. The criminally at risk population has been trending downward. The one that won't be trending downward, of course, is the elderly. We think the poverty rate will continue to decline. The number of need-based programs will continue to decline slowly. However, the elderly cost, Representative Doherty mentioned senior housing, those types of situations are going to only continue to increase substantially over the coming, really, 20 years as the baby boomers move into the retirement, not just the next 10, which is the far out as our forecast goes. And that's all I had for prepared remarks. I know we're running short on time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How important are some of the other things that you didn't mention? You mentioned education, construction, plumbing. But the agriculture and value added from that, manufacturing, sales of natural resources, high tech and intellectual, you know, these are the things that bring dollars into the state and basically build the prosperity of the state to help with all of these other things. And what is the significance of those jobs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, the significance is very, very high. The traded sector jobs are very important in bringing that in. With the agriculture sector, we have a lot of value added. We have a lot of production. We have a lot of sales. But as some of the conversation has talked about earlier, the wages in the industry, you know, are less so than in the typical industry. A lot of the seasonal migrant labor in particular is not high paying for the workers themselves, but it does bring a lot of income, particularly in the rural areas, right? The grains out east, the higher wheat prices have done quite well for farmers in northeastern Oregon in the last 5 years. The high-tech industry is not only does it have high-paying jobs and brings in some of those outside dollars, it also attracts skilled labor. We're getting a ton of in-migration among the young and college-educated folks, which is a tremendous boon to Oregon. And it has been one of our comparative advantages for really since the dawn of time, at least since Lewis and Clark, where people want to move here regardless of whether they have a job or not. You know, they move here, and that helps increase the productivity and the capacity of the Oregon economy.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going through looking at this, I'm just wondering if you've thrown in policy decisions due to land use, environmental factors, things like that, because we used to have a lot of paper mills, sawmills, things like that, and those are the jobs that you said we've lost for those jobs. So I'm just wondering if you've looked at policy decisions that have changed that and then compared it with states that are doing very well in the mid-range, and if you know a couple of those states that have taken off with that middle class and made it booming. Because to me, when I look at it, you have to have a balance of jobs that are that whole across the whole spectrum, because once you lose one, everything else is going to start crumbling around it, is the way I see it. And you can let me know if I'm wrong on that.
Mr. Chair, Rusted Winder. By and large, you're right in terms of some of the historical wood products jobs in the state were somewhere around a third of what we used to be. You know, but that's been a 30, 40-year transition. So we don't have an explicit policy factor built in for that, but we certainly have those trends ongoing. One of the other things with a lot of those wood products jobs is not only have we lost a lot of them, they no longer pay significantly better than the average industry. A lot of that has to do with the increased automation in the mills. I'm thinking more lumber mills and less paper mills because are we down to one paper mill left in the state? Something like that. And the sawmills aren't too far behind in terms of the longer trends. They used to pay back in the 70s, they used to pay 35-40% more than the typical job in the state of Oregon, the wood products industry did. Today, they just pay the state average. Some of that has to do with the other jobs and the other wages coming up, but it also has to do with the slow erosion of the wage within the industry as the mills have become supremely more efficient and more automated than they ever have before. That is so you have to, you know, there's not only policy factors, there's also those ongoing technological change factors that have impacted, and then of course those are also more concentrated in some regions of the state than the others regarding the historical wood product stuff.
The middle wage jobs in other states?
Other states. Where Oregon is somewhere in the middle of the pack, ballpark. I don't know their exact ranking in terms of that. And they got hit everywhere except for the places that had the oil and gas boom. You know, North Dakota, Texas, places like that. We saw tremendous gains in a lot of those there. So those are really the outliers, say, in the last decade. To go back and look over an extended period of time, Oregon has done well, particularly considering the 1990s. Again, a lot of the blue-collar middle-wage jobs, even the white-collar middle-wage jobs, can be thought of as population-driven, right? If you have more people, you need more plumbers to fix their homes. If you have more people, you have more kids, and you need more teachers to teach them, and the like. And in the 90s, we had tremendous population growth, and that brought a lot of those jobs. In the 2000s, we saw slower population gains, a little above the national average, but slower than we've historically seen, and so we've seen a slowdown in those. And so maybe we ranked a little less well in the 2000s, but we ranked quite well in the 90s. This, specific other states, I'd look for population gains. Utah, you know, other western states, Nevada, even with their housing downturn, has done well over the 20 years. A lot of the small western states, of which Oregon is one, have typically outperformed. The laggards are the industrial Midwest, the Great Lakes states, and the Northeast. But, I mean, that sort of longer-run trend is apparent across basically any economic indicator you look at.
So I will note, you know, in your discussion of the wood products industry, because I'm pretty familiar with it, as watching those wages not keep pace. Essentially, it would also, not that there's a direct relationship, but certainly a correlation at that same time period, those mills also became less represented by unions in those production facilities across time, and on top of the automation and the other aspects that you mentioned, those wages have really not kept pace with being middle income wage institutions or facilities anymore. I'm really curious, you made one comment about adding $5,000 a year, I believe it was, to that lower wage demographic, and what difference that would make in the revenue for the state and lessen the budgetary pressures as well for the state. That was an interesting statistic. And if I do the math, that would be an increase of about $3 an hour.
Mr. Chair, if we're talking, you know, nearly full-time work, and purely if we're talking minimum wage, there, yeah, you're right. That the $5,000 would about $3 an hour.
Right. So, those statistics will be interesting for us to really look at and try to capture that, you know, that impact that has, because it starts to address that issue of where that benefit cliff issue as well, you know, and so that was sort of you know, why we're looking at this in the context of low wages and the impacts of potentially raising the, you know, the discussions around minimum wage, or what impact that's really going to have on our economy, on jobs, and, you know, the availability of jobs, and what it does do to our economy and all. So I really appreciate your testimony this morning and being here. And we've just expired our time, and people are just disappearing. So thank you very much for being here.
Very good presentation.
Yeah, very, very good. Very interesting.
Always appreciate your offers.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
That's Dave.
If you guys need anything else from us, just let us know.
We will. Thank you. With that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor, and we will be meeting on Friday at 8 a.m.
Yay!
Yay! Love Friday. Love Friday. Yay!